This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film Dogma is an irreverent comedy about Catholicism written and directed by a deeply committed Catholic, Kevin Smith. He also made the films Clerks and Chasing Amy. Dogma stars Ben Affleck and Matt Damon as two renegade angels exiled to live in Wisconsin but determined to somehow get back to heaven. Their attempt to do so may inadvertently lead to the end of the world. Chris Rock, Alan Rickman, and Linda Fiorentino play a group of angels and mortals determined to prevent this accidental apocalypse. Here's Damon and Affleck as the two exiled angels talking on a bus headed toward New Jersey, which they think will be their gateway back to heaven.
You know, maybe you're wrong about this slaughter thing. How can you even be sure what incurs the Lord's wrath these days? Times change. I remember when eating meat on a Friday was supposed to be a hell-worthy trespass.
The major sins never change. And besides, you know, I can spot a commandment breaker from like a mile away. So, oh, bet on it.
This from the guy who still owes me $10 over that bet about which was going to be the bigger movie, E.T. or Crush Groove.
You know, man, because time's going to tell on that one. What are you insinuating, that I don't have what it takes anymore?
Insinuating? No. Flat out telling you.
Right there. There's one.
So, they're kissing.
Adultery?
Adultery.
You are just a simple creature.
Am I right or what?
Well, I happen to know the truth, but I'm not going
to
tell you.
I asked Kevin Smith to describe the premise of his film Dogma.
In the movie, we maintain that God is absolutely infallible. And that's kind of the fulcrum upon which the lever of the movie sits. And if you're Catholic or a Christian, then I guess it's pretty much the same thing. What we then maintain in the movie, that is, if anything could prove God fallible, that infallibility would kind of be shuttered, and the up would become down, black would become white, and existence would kind of end. It would become nothingness. It's not like the whole world would end. It's not like the apocalypse. It would just cease to be. There are two angels in the movie who were kind of cast out of heaven eons ago, Bartleby and Loki, and they were cast out by God's holy decree. And they've been on earth for ages. And they found a loophole in Catholic dogma through this concept called the plenary indulgence, that by walking through the doorway of this church at a particular time would wipe their slate clean of all existing sin, hence giving them kind of a clean slate, and they could then die and go to heaven. But if they re-enter heaven, what they don't know is that it'll prove God fallible, and existence would end. So they're kind of unwittingly setting this chain of events in motion. It's kind of convoluted, isn't it, Terry?
That's why I asked you to explain it.
Exactly.
Being no fool myself.
I'm sitting here going, boy, that sounds dodgy at best. But it's kind of how the movie sets itself up.
No, the angels and devils and prophets in the movie are kind of like characters in superhero comics.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if when you were a kid and learning about religion and reading superhero comics, if the two ever came together in your mind, if angels seemed like superheroes.
Terry, I'm 29, and angels still seem like superheroes. I have a strong kind of religious upbringing, and I'm still deeply rooted in my own faith and beyond my chosen faith of Catholicism, just my faith in God in general, because they're two completely different things, which I imagine we'll touch on later. But I've also been raised on comic books and continue to be a big comic book aficionado, and going so far as to actually own a comic book store. It's something that's always played a big part in my life. It's a viable medium of art that in the United States doesn't seem to get all the credit it's due. You know, comic books are kind of wonderful because they're the blending of two mediums, like graphic arts and literature. But most times people dismiss comic books as you know, something for kids, because that's what they're primarily identified with, or who they're primarily identified with. So there's a lot of comic book kind of a background to this movie in general. I mean, I've seen a few criticisms of the movie where they say that the movie's too comic booky, or comic booky in general, and I always think that's great. You know, I'm never like, wow, that's a harsh criticism. I'm like, yeah, well, that's what we were trying to do, make a living comic book.
Did you particularly like the iconography of Catholicism, you know, the angels and the saints and all the imagery of Christ on the cross? I mean, Catholicism is really rich in imagery.
It's very ornate, to say the least. Of all the faiths, it's probably the most ornate and most ritualistic, and very much like going to a Broadway show, you know, when you go to Mass. It's a lot of costumes, you know, great lighting, wonderful speeches, and even it's like dinner theater because you get to eat in the middle of the Mass as well, to some degree, if you take part in communion. But I don't know. That's kind of where I later grew up and started looking at Catholicism and a little more seriously or a little deeply, and started looking at how people invest so much in those symbols. And less in the kind of mindset of the philosophy that Christ had upon which we built our faith. It seems like a lot of people would kind of break their necks to stop a crucifix from falling, you know, on the floor than they would to cross the street and give some guy a buck, you know, who's got no sandwich or no money or something like that.
My guest is Kevin Smith. He wrote and directed the new film Dogma. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kevin Smith. He wrote and directed the new film Dogma, a comedy about faith and Catholicism. As someone now who's very, visually oriented through, comic books and making movies, I'm wondering if there were images of, Christian paintings or Bible drawings or stained glass that really stuck with you from when you were a kid, and if any of them particularly frightened you or seemed particularly beautiful.
Not really, because if you look at the flicks I've done so far, I'm not a very visual person. I'd go so far as to say I'm something of an inept director. My aesthetic is really bad. There's not much of a difference between our first, second, and third film. The fourth film looks a little better than the first three, and I do love comic books, but I'm always about the substance and kind of not the style. So I'm the last guy in the world to ask, is there anything that visually kind of did anything for you? My stuff is kind of weak visually. But there's a lot of things that I heard and learned growing up that stuck with me and wound up in Dogma, something like the plenary indulgence. When I was in Catholic school, when I was a kid, our parish had its centennial, its 100th anniversary, and there was a papal decree granting us a day of plenary indulgence, where if you walk through the front doors on that day, you know, you got a clean slate. And it was, what a notion it was. It stuck with me forever. I mean, so I was like, so wait, if we walk through the door, anything I've done is gone. They're like, oh, yes. So I guess it was more for the kids, right? Because how bad could anything we have done at that point have been? I mean, I've since learned that some plenary indulgences, depending on how deep they are or how official they are, don't wipe away all your sins, mostly venial type sins.
So did you walk through the church door and get your sins wiped away?
You better believe it. And I was one of those guys politicking for it to be a weekly event. You know? Let's do it every week. Let's wipe the slate clean.
Tell me if this is too personal, but what was your idea back then of a terrible sin?
When I was a kid, I guess stealing was pretty bad. I mean, because, shoplifting was a big thing when I was something of a kid. When you got to my age then, when I was about 10 or 11, you'd skip down to the candy store, Katz's convenience store in town, and try to pinch comic books or some candy that you didn't have money for. Or I remember once I felt incredibly guilty about taking $5 out of my mother's wallet and going to play Centipede, the video game, for hours at the local convenience store. And that was pretty bad as it got. A few years later, it would be masturbation for a little while. You know, that became very, very guilt-inducing for about a week. And then you get over it because you like it so much.
Now, did you find a way to stay Catholic and absolve yourself of masturbation at the same time?
I think every Catholic does to some degree. We're a very litigious bunch because we're always looking for the ways around the rules. I mean, you have 10 commandments, right? And you're always looking for the language between them. We're very kind of legalistic. We're like lawyers because these are the rules, and we always try to find our ways around the rules so you can exist and still be a child of God or still not sin too badly, which is why a lot of kids who went to Catholic school were we were always asking questions when we got into our preteens and early teens about so petting, where does that stand? Is that considered adultery? Or, there's no commandment that says thou shalt not feel up or go to second base or something like that. So I was trying to find ways around that kind of thing. I must have found ways to settle with masturbation.
Well, there's at least one group that's saying you broke the rules and broke them in a very evil way. And I'm thinking of the Catholic League, which condemned your film.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, let me quote the president of the Catholic League, Bill Donahue. I read this in a newspaper, so I'm assuming he actually said it. He said, "I don't care if Kevin Smith goes to Mass every day. He's a self-hating Catholic who probably had a bad experience in the sixth grade when Sister Mary rapped him over the knuckles, and he's never gotten over it. My advice to him is to seek therapy and to stop living in the past. I don't take on people for criticizing the Catholic Church. I take them on when they cross over the line from dissent to disdain."
And he sets the line, I guess? I mean, read that statement back to yourself and just think, like, this came from a so-called Christian, like a guy who's sitting there telling me that I need therapy or hypothesizing that the only reason I would make a movie like this is because I was abused by a sister, propagating yet another stereotype of Catholicism that we all got wrapped across the knuckles in Catholic school. That dude is as guilty as the people he points out. And Bill Donahue, or old Bill as we call him around the office because we're familiar with him now after 6-7 months of persecution at his hands, occurs to me as no less than a Pharisee or a Sadducee, you know, the kind of high priest that Christ wouldn't waste his time with when he was here, because he so piously points out the faults of others. And really, who made him the guy? Who gave him the yardstick? You know, who told him he could put the line in the sand? Catholic Church, Terry, has never said anything about this movie. And I would imagine they'd be the authorities in this case. Bill Donahue and his Catholic League are self-appointed media watchdogs who watch everything, TV and movies, or don't watch everything, as was the case in this movie. For 6-7 months, he went after us without having seen a frame of film. And go after them for being anti-Catholic and maintain that there is this Catholic bashing that exists that's not fair because you can't bash Jews. I mean, one of his arguments is, if I can't wait for the day somebody makes a movie bashing Jews, or what would happen if somebody made a movie bashing Jews? You know, you would see the outcry then. And it's kind of like, what kind of Christian approach is that? That you're like, all right, well, if we have to get bashed, I want to see someone else get bashed and see how they feel about it. Whatever happened to turning the other cheek? I mean, you want to talk about disdain. The man is filled with disdain and contempt, and those aren't really the values of a Christian. That's not really following the example of Christ.
Were you expecting that your movie was going to be controversial?
No, not at all. I thought since we were staying away from like the central figure or icon of Christianity, that being Christ, we'd be okay. I mean, of course, I saw what happened to Mr. Scorsese in The Last Temptation of Christ, and to me, as sad as that was, because, boy, is that movie a pro-faith film, it kind of made somewhat sense, because all people ever heard about that movie was, that's the movie where Christ has sex, you know, and people get up in arms about it because you're attributing behavior to Christ that normally isn't attributed to him. However, they leave out the context, right, where it's like, well, that's the movie in which Christ is dying on the cross and has a delusion about what his life would have been like if he had been a man, lived a normal life of a man and not, you know, the life of the Son of God, and got married and had sex and had children, and then comes out as a delusion and dies on the cross like he's supposed to. No, all they ever feed you is the one line, like, Christ does sex. And I saw what happened with that movie, and I was like, well, look, as long as we don't have Jesus in our movie, I think we're okay, because we don't really have any biblical characters, so to speak, with the exception of God, and nobody could really say that our portrayal of God is blasphemous unless you think falling down in the middle of a handstand is the utter, you know, contempt of blasphemy or something. So I thought we were all right. I thought the real controversy would come from people who'd seen our other flicks, like Clerks and Mars and Chasing Amy, coming out of this movie going, God, what happened to the Clerks guy? He used to be funny, and now all he wants to do is talk about church and Jesus.
Disney dropped its plans to distribute Dogma. Was that a result of the Catholic League's protest?
Absolutely. But I mean, to be fair, it wasn't Disney. Nobody from Disney called us up and said, we're dumping your movie. There was a moment where when the protesting started initially, and there was an article in Premier Magazine about it, and the Catholic League, and this was back in, I think, March of 99, early this year, the Catholic League controversy started kicking in, or they started talking about the movie more and demanding answers and calling for protest, that Disney suddenly was alerted to the existence of the movie and asked Harvey Weinstein, the chairman of Miramax, to send them a copy so they can watch. And Harvey sent a copy over to Joe Roth, who's the chairman of the movie division there. And we heard back from Harvey that Joe had said he liked the movie, but he thought it was the most subversive movie he'd ever seen. And so I said to Harvey, well, what does that mean? And Harvey said, it doesn't mean anything. As long as it's not an NC-17 movie, Miramax can release this. And then we started having this discussion about how good it was to be a Disney movie at this point, because it seemed like they were attracting undue attention to us as much as we were attracting undue attention to them. And it wasn't helping the movie to be a Disney movie, because that's what made us the focus of the Catholic League attack. So Harvey said, well, there's a few options, and one starts with me buying the movie back, and we can take it somewhere else. And I've been involved with some studios. He'd done Shakespeare in Love with Universal, and he'd done Sliding Doors with Paramount, and All the Pretty Horses, a movie that Matt Damon is in, is coming out later next year, with Columbia. And he said, well, we can probably take it to one of these studios. And I said, great, all right, let's get it as far away from Disney as possible, because we were a target around their neck and they were a target around ours. But once we got away from Miramax and Disney, I mean, the same problem came up with every studio. You know, it's just like they're all corporate power structures, and none of them really want to take a bullet from the religious right or from the Catholic League, not over this movie. So everyone pretty much passed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kevin Smith, and he wrote and directed the current comedy Dogma. One of the characters in Dogma is Cardinal Glick, who's played by George Carlin. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to make Catholicism more like upbeat and appealing through a new PR campaign. So instead of depressing images of Jesus crucified, one of his slogans is, "Our buddy Jesus." Mm-hmm. And his other slogan is, "Catholicism, wow."
Right.
Was there something in particular that inspired that satire?
When I'd written this back in 94, the first draft of it, there was really nothing that I was satirizing short of myself, because I realized, well, here I am making a movie about faith and making a movie about Catholicism particularly, and I'm kind of coming down on the side of it. You know, I believe in Catholicism, but I just happen to think church is good, but God is better. But inasmuch I saw myself as something of a salesman for the whole thing, because I'm trying to put forward the idea of faith to an audience that maybe hasn't thought about faith since their parents stopped dragging them to church. So I kind of felt like I had to satirize myself, and that's where Cardinal Glick comes from. But cut to a few years later, and I heard at one point that there was a Jerry Falwell. I don't know if it was Jerry Falwell or... not Jerry Falwell. What's his name? Pat Robertson, mm-hmm. is that his name? One of these guys who was starting a campaign, a multi-million-dollar campaign, advertising campaign, to turn the Bible into something a little more hip called The Book. And they were going to try to sell it to the youth as something a little more manageable, something they could swallow a little more. And I thought that was kind of funny. I thought it was kind of in keeping with what we were talking about in the movie.
Well, one of the characters in your film says, look, people only know Bible history that's been in movies. And it strikes me, you missed out on the biblical epic era.
Yeah.
I was too young for that. Did you go back and watch it all on video?
I mean, I watched a lot of it when I was a kid. Every year they'd rerun both The Wizard of Oz and the...
Ten Commandments.
And I guess the movie is kind of a cross between the two, if you look at it. Dogma's not that far removed from both of those flicks. I guess it's a lifetime of growing up watching those two flicks back to back that might have resulted in a movie like Dogma.
My guest is Kevin Smith. He wrote and directed the new film Dogma. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kevin Smith. He wrote and directed the new film Dogma, a comedy about faith and Catholicism. Now, in Dogma, you play Silent Bob again, as is a recurring character in your films.
Right.
And describe Silent Bob.
Silent Bob is essentially the only way to describe him is to describe the character Jay, who he's constantly partnered with. He's the antithesis of the Jay character, and Jay basically is wiry, always moving, and constantly yammering. So Silent Bob is the exact opposite on every front. He's kind of the quiet muscle, sober yin to Jay's raging yang, and they kind of make up this little duo of pure id, I guess, you know, just constantly speaking without thinking. The Jay character does. Silent Bob's a little more thoughtful.
And in Dogma, they play, would you say, prophets?
Yeah, they're supposed to be prophets in the movie, kind of unwitting prophets. They don't really understand it or get it. But those characters, I think, are the common person's way into a movie that's kind of steeped in theology or particularly Catholic history or Catholic theology or even Catholic mythology, which some people call it, but I don't, of course, because it's all true, right? I was raised in the faith. But they're kind of the every man's way into it, because there are people who don't think about faith, don't think about God, don't think about their own religion. And Jay and Silent Bob represent those two characters in this movie, two guys who all they really think about is living, breathing, sleeping, eating, you know, having sex. That's just the real basic kind of stuff. And they're the comic relief in the movie, and thank God they're there, because otherwise the movie might get too full of itself or too full of hot air, and they're kind of the pin that you kind of press into the balloon to deflate some of that hot air.
Now, Jason Mewes, who plays Jay, the real talkative one, the opposite of Silent Bob, he's someone who's, you know, where every other word is dude.
Yeah, right.
No, he's a real friend of yours, right?
Yeah, he's a guy I've known for about 10 years now, and kind of the character he plays is kind of who he was when he was 15. It's kind of a romanticized version of who he was when he was about 15 years old. And he's a great guy and just one of those people that other people come up to you and say, I know a guy just like Jay, you know, which is kind of always works in the favor of the movies we've done, because there's this identity factor. People see themselves or their friends and the characters that we kind of put out there.
Do you channel his 15-year-old voice?
I have
to. When you write for him?
Yeah, pretty much. And it's funny because I'll write to his inflections and his mannerisms and who he was when he was then. And I'll give him the script, and invariably he always says the same thing. I'm like, what do you think? He's like, I don't know if I can do it. And I said, dude, it's you. How can you not? And then we spend a month rehearsing, you know, trying to teach Jay to be Jay. And then people see the movie and they go, God, he's such a natural. I'm like, yeah, he's a real natural. But this time around, he actually blew me out of the water. He was so good. We'd been preparing him for so long for this movie, because he has more screen time than he ever had before. And I was saying, you know, you got to be serious this time around. I can't hold your hand through this movie. And we got major stars in the movie now, and we got Alan Rickman in the movie. And he's like, who's that? And I said, Alan Rickman, you know, he's a British actor. He was in Die Hard, Yippee-ki-yay. And he goes, oh, yeah, I know that guy. I said, yeah, but more than that movie, he's a British actor, and they invented acting. And he'll chew you up and spit you out, man. I mean, this guy, he doesn't stand for any of your snoochie-boochie nonsense. So you got to stand tall and be more professional this time around, or else Rickman's going to be real ticked. So when it came to time to start rehearsing, and I usually kind of start with him a few weeks earlier than anybody else, we were sitting in a room together. And I said, where's your script? And he said, I didn't bring it. And I said, oh, this ought to be great. And he said, no, I memorized my lines. I said, you did not. And he said, try me. So I would do the lines opposite his lines, and then he would do his lines, and he memorized them. And I was blown away. I was like, oh, my God, you memorized your lines already? And he said, yeah, everyone else is too. I said, you memorize the whole script? He said, yeah, and I do other people's lines, and he knew their lines as well. And I said, why on earth would you memorize the whole script? And he's like, I didn't want to tick off that Rickman dude. And I was and it was really great, because he had this kind of vision of Alan Rickman as a drill sergeant of sorts. And then the day they actually met him, you know, he was kind of leery of him. And then you meet Alan. Alan's a real sweetheart, and he's not nearly this vicious Shakespearean actor that Mewes had pictured in his head, I guess.
Yeah, but your little ruse worked well.
It did. It worked really well, because he gave a banner performance in this movie and broke through whatever ceiling it was he was under.
You still own a comic book store. What's it like in your store now that you're, you know, a pretty well-known movie director? Do people come in looking for you?
Yeah, most times people come in thinking that I'm actually working the register. And I like to go in there and hang out, because my friends work there. My friend Walter runs the place, and my friend Brian can be there sometimes, and my friend Vincent runs the place sometimes. So I'll go and hang out with them and talk to them and whatnot. But the store is great. We've kind of turned it into this kind of little museum showcase as well. When we first moved into it, we had picked it up from a guy who had it in town, but he was moving, and asked if we wanted to buy the store. And I said, yeah. So we put a new coat of paint on it and changed the name of the store to Jay and Silent Bob Secret Stash. And we started getting out of town traffic, then out of state traffic, and then cross country traffic, and then international traffic, because they'd seen the movies and they would come down to the store. And I felt bad for them, because there was really nothing of any interest or import at the store. So we got a bigger location up the block and really decked it out. We had our art director, Ratface, did the store up really sweet, and we have a bunch of movie memorabilia hanging around, so it's kind of like Planet Hollywood, but hopefully it won't go into bankruptcy court anytime soon. But it's like this Planet Hollywood kind of thing, where there's props from the movies, like the Buddy Christ statues there, Jay and Silent Bob costumes from some of the movies are up there, little things that you've seen in all the movies are kind of hanging up around, and people dig it, you know, they come by and really appreciate the whole thing.
Since your movie is about trying to prevent the end of the world, and since a lot of people think that the apocalypse might coincide with the end of the millennium, I'm wondering what you're doing New Year's Eve.
Me, I would just love to sit home and watch TV. But that's just me. Unfortunately, or fortunately for me, but unfortunately for my social calendar, I got married this year. And my wife is not a big, let's sit around and watch TV on New Year's Eve type of person. So the wife is looking for something really special to go down, particularly because it's the end of the millennium, if you will, and turn of the century. And so we're trying to figure it out. And I may actually wind up doing something for a change. And she's talking about maybe going on a cruise. Or I'm a huge Prince fan, or the artist formerly known as Prince. And I heard that he's actually playing at Paisley Park and doing this pay-per-view concert. And that's definitely something I would really, Marco, if I can get to, I would go to that. I would definitely spend New Year's in Minneapolis to see the artist, particularly performing like 1999 in 1999. That'd be kind of cool, wouldn't it? So we're going to do something like that. But we also have got a little bundle of joy in the mix, like we had a baby. So that kind of tempers, I guess, what our plans may be for New Year's Eve, because, you know, we can't leave the baby at home by herself.
You're raising your baby in the faith?
Yeah, I just had her baptized about, what, three weeks ago. Had her baptized, which was, I guess, traumatizing for her. I mean, we stripped her bare naked and immersed her completely three times in the water in front of a crowd full of people. So I can understand she'll probably have Catholic issues when she grows up as well.
Hey, it's nothing compared to circumcision.
No, not in the least. I mean, I'm not going to tell her that for a few years. But
well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having back, man. It's great.
Kevin Smith wrote and directed the new film Dogma.